Would you give your mum, dad, aunt or that uncle who hugged your partner a little too long free access to your phone?
Oh, no!
Oh, my God, it's a really long video. Ew!
In Dave's brand new YouTube original, Get Off My Phone, we've got six comedians to give their phones over to a relative with total freedom to read messages, DMs, photos and browser history.
Where's your search history?
Sorry?
What to do, tips for relief.
The rules are simple. Their relative can read anything they want and even make calls from the comedian's phone.
What is this?
What is... I don't want this one.
That looks really bad.
Starring Tanya Moore, Anya Magliano, Finlay Christie, Travis J with his mum Angie Lamar, Hayley Morris, Grace Campbell and dad Alistair Campbell.
Slightly sexually compromising
people. Divulging their deepest digital secrets.
What the hell is happening?
Get Off My Phone, a Dave YouTube original. Available now on Dave's YouTube channel.
Hello and welcome to another podtacular episode of the Dave Weekly. I'm Ben Shires and you, well, you are just swell for listening. By swell, I don't mean you've put on any weight. If anything, you sound slimmer. You obviously went easy on the barbecues this summer. That shows great resolve. Well done, you. I, on the other hand, spent my summer avoiding the sun's unforgiving rays on my porcelain Yorkshire skin and also taking a visit around some of Britain's great historical sites, including Hadrian's Wall and Edinburgh Castle. And I discovered that if there's a certain type of castle I particularly like, it's a Mott and Bailey, which is a highly roundabout way of introducing today's illustrious first guest, the man who's been described in a recent Saga article as having a startled, affable demeanour, and also someone who hasn't exactly been at the forefront of television. But what do they know? He has described himself as part troll, which sounds to me a lot more accurate. It's the inimitable qualm peddler himself, Bill Bailey. And he's joined by someone whose name, well, I just can't really tenuously link it to any stronghold or fortification, but who may have Tourette's syndrome. Come on! It's Andrew Lawrence. Hello, Bill Bailey. Welcome to the Dave Weekly.
Hello there, and great to be here.
Yeah. I mean, we've already had a false start, but that, if anything, has just set us up for a more interesting chat, I feel.
Yeah, exactly.
Because we've done the pleasantries now, we've done the formalities.
Let's get down to business.
Exactly.
Brass tacks.
Business is what we're here for.
Come on.
So, I mean, this is ostensibly our first meeting.
Yes.
Although, as I'm sure you're aware, we were once eating in the same Chinese restaurant 2 years ago.
Ooh, I was not aware of that fact. But which restaurant?
Just pull this dagger out of my
was
front.
It? And then I might be able to zone in on that particular area of my memory.
It was one in Chinatown. And
yes.
I think it's called Leong's Legends 2, which is one of the few Chinese restaurants to have a sequel.
Yes, and also a video game by the sound of it.
Long's Legends. It's got a little walkway, like a little bridge that you go over and a little fountain.
Yes, I know it very well.
Yeah.
Yes, I do remember it. I remember being in it.
Yeah.
But I must admit, I can't quite remember us both being at the same time. But I was quite peckish at the time. I was probably focusing more on the food.
But that's fair enough.
I'm just saying.
Put it out there. Yeah. I mean, they do say you can probably tell the quality of a Chinese restaurant based on how many Chinese people are eating in there. And the fact that we two and our entourages were basically the only people in there.
Yes, there's a good sign.
Yeah.
That's right. And there's another one as well. There's a restaurant very close to me, which is a Sichuan restaurant, which is superb. But yeah, again, it's entirely, the entire clientele is Chinese. But not only that, they're Sichuan Chinese. And they all speak in the Sichuan dialect. And there's a lot of dishes there which I have no idea.
Yeah, just point and
what
order.
They are. Just what they're having.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I always think that methodology, though, kind of falls down if you go to a restaurant in China. Because surely they're all populated by Chinese people then.
That's true, yeah.
How do you make your choice?
Well, that is true. And having been to China last year, where we did travel to lots of different provinces, there are areas where you just have to kind of, you know, take the plunge, really, because we tried some. There's different kinds of cuisines I've never tried before, from the Dao people and from the Bao people.
And you don't want to get those mixed up.
If you get the Dao and the Bao, you know, I mean, it's radically, radically different. But they were quite fantastically different. They were. I mean, we were in Yunnan province, which is in the southwest of China. And one of the dishes seemed, and I think probably was, made from pine needles.
Ah.
It was a salad of pine needles. And it sounds like something you just, you know, like some sweepings on sort of, you know, like kind of round about the 29th of December.
Yeah, I mean, it may well have been, but it was, oh, we've got some English people in, give them the sweepings.
Give them the sweepings, they love that. Yeah, if you could put one of those little chocolate decorations in as well and some old sausage rolls, they'd love it. No, but it was really quite fantastically different. And I have to say, being a great lover of Chinese food as well, it was something very odd.
Well, it's massively different, isn't it? The actual Chinese food from the anglicised version that we have over here.
Absolutely.
I had a girlfriend who went to China a few years ago, and she was horrified when she ordered what she thought was chicken, but then it was just chicken's feet.
Ah.
And, yeah, I mean, there's not a lot, I think, to get out of chicken's feet.
I don't know. I've had chicken's feet, and you're right, there's not a lot on them.
I mean, unless you're particularly into claws.
But there's, you know, with the right spice, there's a certain kind of, I don't know, a sort of strange appeal.
Tenderny, ankly goodness.
Yes, something. Toes, yeah. Chicken's toes.
Well, I think this one's still got a bit of corn trapped in its claw.
Oh, look at that, yeah. I wouldn't say I would have it, you know, on a regular basis, but, you know, it's now and again. You've got to try something a bit different.
Yeah, I watched you on BBC News talking about your new show.
Yeah.
And you actually mentioned liberating a Chinese owl.
That's right, yeah. Well, and this was in a Chinese restaurant in the south east of China, in Guangdong province. And it was seen, I can only imagine it was like a trophy restaurant sort of thing, you know, where you go and you can order some exotic creature. And I think this is very common across China and across Asia as well. That is where local businessmen trying to impress a party official or something will take them there and order something not of any culinary value, but, you know, just purely for the pose value. You know, oh, I can cook a lizard. Yeah. You know, that's how much money I've got. I can, you know, anything you want, a civet cat, you know, a salamander, you know, a cormorant, anything you want.
Spoken like a true gourmand as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was, yeah. You know, and this is I imagine the reason why there was an owl there on the menu. And it was in, you know, in a cage in the front of the restaurant. You know, then there's always this sort of the tanks. Very often Chinese restaurants have, you know, seafood.
Yeah.
So you can pick one. And then next to where all the tanks were cages, and there you could just pick an animal. And there were all these different creatures in there. Some of them I don't even know what they were. They were like,
are you sure this wasn't just a zoo? Sounds very much to me.
You know, I know it does sound like I just, you know, had maybe some, you know, too many arrows or something.
You were the presumptuous Englishman who came in and bought the zoo animals.
How dare you? How dare you? And they're going, no, this is a zoo. And, that's right. No, you know, there were people eating, so I assumed it was, I mean, I might think it was a restaurant. We did eat there as well. I mean, we didn't eat anything from the top row, as it were. We had
the animals covered in plastic.
That's right. But yes, we ate a sort of more traditional Chinese lunch, but then afterwards we haggled with them because we thought, I can't walk away from this amazing creature, which is just sitting there waiting to be eaten. I just thought, is this not a fate that should befall such a creature? So we did haggle with them a little bit, and then we bought it. and it was, so we bought an owl, now what? You know, that was a real, you know, that was
one of those when you only think of the stage one of the plan.
Yeah.
Stage two.
Stage one was, we get the owl and we walk out of the restaurant, triumphant. Yes! And then that's as far as I thought. And then, what are we doing? Now what? And so it was sellotaped up in a box, and we got into a cab and tried to.
You sellotaped an owl.
Sellotaped an owl up and put it in a box. We didn't sellotape it; they did. They sort of thought that was what we wanted.
That's how an owl comes.
That's how it comes.
Do you want it packed?
Take away.
Yeah. Do you want it closed or open?
Yeah. No, take away. Oh, okay. And then we had to sort of, you know, point to various pictures of forests in a.
So you had to get in a taxi with a sellotaped owl.
Sellotaped owl.
And explain
owl in a box.
To a confused taxi driver that.
We wanted to release it.
Yeah. We're here on a very small conservation program.
Release. Yes, right.
Just one owl at a time.
Yeah. And by cab. And.
Is this for owls who like have a terminal illness? You've got to make their dream come true.
That's right, yes. It's a make a wish for an owl. And the owl said to me, wanted to be released. So It was a very odd conversation we had. Well, it wasn't a conversation. It was a lot of pointing. You know, there was a lot of
pointing going on with the
taxi driver. We were trying to find a picture of a wood, you know, a forest or a wooded area.
Is that not in your point and ask phrase book that you get where you just point a picture?
Oh, yeah, that would be brilliant.
I want the wood for the owl release.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be brilliant if there was a photograph of somebody releasing an owl just for your conservation section?
I've got this puff in here. Do you know near a cliff nearby that I can just release him?
I know. So it took a while, but yeah, we did it. We managed it in the end.
Incredible. So, do you know, I had a similar... not-ish experience. I was in America recently, and there's a seafood restaurant where they had a claw grabber game, like you have a sort of seaside amusement arcade.
Oh, right, yeah.
But for lobsters.
Oh, right.
It was live lobsters in a tank that you grabbed with a claw. For the price of $3, you could try your luck. Now, if you've ever done a seaside grabber game, you'll know intrinsically flawed because the claw doesn't work properly.
No purchase. No purchase.
But at least it's an inanimate object. When you try and grab a lobster,
oh no,
just moves.
Yeah, of course.
I spent all my holiday money trying to grab a lobster that just took a step backwards and then it was gone. I had all these dreams of being like Homer Simpson, have my own pinchy that I could bring around with me, a lobster on my shoulder. Nothing.
No, the lobster's looking down. I can't believe they fell for this. I bet the lobsters are the cocky ones. They just lean out of the way. They don't have to move.
Better luck next time.
And also, you're never going to get enough grip in one for a lobster, surely.
Yeah.
There's barely enough grip for some flimsy, cuddly toy. Never mind her.
You'd have to have a lot of cooperation from the lobster, really. He'd have to angle himself just right and then really want to get out.
The lobster might just cling on, you know, just to tease you.
Yeah.
You go, oh, you got me. And then sort of, let go.
Loser.
Ha ha.
Yeah,
fair enough. I read a scurrilous, maybe or maybe even not, a report about lobsters saying they're immortal.
Who was this written by?
This was
because I've eaten lobster. I don't want to think he's still alive.
Clearly not. But this is one of those ones where they say, 100 things you didn't know, and one of them is lobsters are immortal. I thought, this can't be true. Surely we'd have known about this
by now.
This
is written by a teenage lobster.
Lobsters.
He's got a very high opinion of himself.
Yeah, that's right. They'd read Rider Haggard, the lobster that danced in the blue flame. I think if you extrapolate a bit, lobsters do live a very long life and they don't seem to age. I think that's what they were saying. You know, they don't age. They actually get stronger and fitter and more, what should we call it, fertile.
So they're the Benjamin Buttons
of
the sea life world.
Yeah, they're sort of like the rest of us, shuffling inexorably to oblivion. But lobsters seem to be going the other way. They're getting stronger, more fertile.
Here's another fact that I learned recently. Brontosaurus never existed.
No?
Yeah, absolutely true. The guy who discovered Brontosaurus, he found a skeleton without a head and then found a head a few miles down the road and thought, I probably just rolled off miles and put them together and created a dinosaur which was never real.
Never real.
And then called it Brontosaurus. And for years and years and years, people thought, wow. But they're actually two different species of dinosaur just put together for convenience.
Together. God, that's a swizz, isn't it?
I know.
How did he come up with the name then? Was that just a sort of by convenience or something?
Thunder lizard. Maybe it came to him like a flash of lightning inspiration. I was like, I don't know. That's fanciful explanation on my part.
That's a bombshell.
Yeah, I know, Bill. How are you going to deal with that fact now?
That is a real proper... years.
Yeah.
Citing
the Brontosaurus.
Of Brontosauruses?
No, I'm afraid not.
Didn't exist.
I know. But I mean, so one of the things that interests me about your interest.
Don't say that.
Yeah, because we all know that the Easter Bunny and Jesus put together, that's Santa, right? One of your interests when you kind of into sort of like natural history and kind of the flora and fauna of the world.
Yeah.
And you did a brilliant show all about your favourite Victorian explorer and ecologist and proponent of natural selection.
Yes.
And it was. I'm a big Charles Darwin fan, but the two of them came together very, very well.
That's right. But I mean, I was travelling in Indonesia, as I tend to do quite a bit, and
looking for another animal to release.
Yes, right. Anything at all, right? Come on, get out, gerbil out, and it was I was travelling in an area of eastern Indonesia called Wallacea, and that's where I first came across Alfred Russel Wallace, the name. And it was about sort of 15 odd years ago, and I just became fascinated in this character and this where how he managed to get to Indonesia, what he did, what he achieved. And the more I read about him, the more this story unfolded, this extraordinary life that he'd lived. You know, he'd come from this sort of quite a humble background, and then he'd managed to get himself up to the Amazon with his friend, and they did a trip around the Amazon collecting specimens, and then all these specimens were lost, and then he still carried on. He still wanted to find this reason, this solution, the answer to why there were so many species. And yes, it was and walking in these footsteps was a fantastic experience. Mm. He and Darwin. I mean, there's a lot written about Wallace and Darwin, and a lot of it is all very scurrilous stuff about the kind of who came up with evolution first. Yeah. Was it people say, oh, Darwin and Wallace had nothing to do with it, and then there's the Wallace camp, which say that actually Wallace's theory of evolution was far more consistent with what we now consider to be evolution. So it's a big old hot potato. But the thing I find is very touching about it is that Wallace and Darwin became friends.
Yeah, and, well, they collaborated, didn't they, and presented theories together in the end.
Yeah.
What I think is really interesting about your love for these characters is that they're men of substance. They're people who actually did something with their lives. And in the Victorian era, they did actually become celebrities.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of the Strand magazine, which is where Sherlock Holmes was first published.
Oh, yeah.
And each week it had a section on celebrities of the day. And it was scientists, it was bishops, it was MPs, it was the occasional billiards player. You know, people, men who actually were doing things in the world. And I think it kind of ties in quite nicely with one of the things that you balk against in your new show,
absolutely,
Guam Peddler, about sort of celebrity and the nature of the ridiculousness of it now.
Yeah, exactly right. And as you say, you quite rightly mentioned. Victorian era was very much about that. Wallace, became what we would now consider a celebrity. He became very, very well known. He probably, towards the end of the 19th century, he was probably one of the most famous people in the world due to his, his scientific, discoveries and his papers and his a lot of the laws and the books that he'd written. But yes, I mean, even when I was a kid, growing up, there were astronauts that attained celebrity. There were explorers. There were people, as you say, men of substance, people of substance, and it's one of the things I talk about in the show. Well, one of the reasons, the kind of spur to start writing the show, initially, when it was almost like a year and a half ago now, and that was the nature of modern celebrity, the disposable nature of it, this ephemeral nature of it, and how we crave it. There's a desire for the new, the latest one, and it's all very disposable. People are disposable. Oh, yeah, we like them for a bit, right? I'm bored of them. Let's have another one. Oh, what do they go? Have they got any flaws? We can like anything wrong with them? Right, okay. They say, oh, they're quite funny. They'll sell a few magazines because there's so much to fill. There's so many magazines. There's so many social media sites. We need more and more of this stuff, and it's a law of diminishing returns because each time you add another person to the list of roster of people that are supposedly in the news, there's less of them, there's less to fill, so it's like, oh, they could just be like, they like nice handbags, or they, it's literally almost as like what kind of dresses they wear or what kind of suits they wear or who they've been seen with, and rather than an attainment.
But can anyone deny that Alfred Russel Wallace would have looked better with a glowing tan and his own range of condoms?
Well, I think he probably did have a tan.
Aiding natural selection.
That's right, yeah. Actually, that's quite a good... Yeah, yeah. The Wallace collection.
Yeah, I think that's actually a museum there. They might have issue.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Compared to prophylactics. Sorry about that.
Bill, it's been lovely to chat to you. Where can people see your show? Because you're all over, aren't you?
I am all over it. I start the tour this Saturday in the Lowry in Salford, in Manchester.
Nice.
And then I'll do two shows there, and then the tour sort of wends its way all around the country from then on. And you can find all the details at my website.
Incredible. Well, come along, go see Bill Bailey pedal more of his qualms.
Yes.
And songs as well. We didn't really talk about them, but there'll be lots of songs in there too.
There's a lot of music, reggae, Downton Abbey, and a dubstep hymn. So, something for everyone.
Everything you'd expect. All right, thanks a lot, Bill.
You're welcome.
From one man who's used to liberating owls to another who finds it a lot more difficult to get close to birds, here's Andrew Lawrence. Okay, I'm joined on the Dave Wheatley, this time by Andrew Lawrence. Hello.
Hello, hi.
I'm good. What? I'm good? I just assumed that you said, how are you?
Yeah, well, you know, take it as if I said, how are you? I meant it. I genuinely
care.
Yeah,
it was implied within hello, wasn't it?
I'd love to know about your well-being. Tell me everything.
Yeah, well, this is a great start. This is how I like to begin conversations, with an awkward fumbling.
But are you all right, though? It sounds like you might be.
I think I am. Very difficult
struggling
question
with things
to answer, really.
Because this early at the start of the interview.
An underlying tension already in my voice. Yeah, I'm just... I had a situation like that actually the other day. You know, when someone says... Someone's working in, like, you know, a shop or a position, and they say something which is relevant to you but not to them. I was getting on a plane... And the woman who checked my ticket said, oh, thank you, sir. Have a nice flight. And I was like, you too. She wasn't getting on the plane.
But yeah, it's kind of classic, like, the you too. Yeah, you too, whatever people say to you.
We're so indoctrinated to say certain stock responses. It's like that classic British thing where someone does something like to you, like barges into you, and you say, oh, sorry. As if there's some kind of, you know, responsibility on your part.
But the worst thing is, I wish I could... I never seem to address it afterwards. I just let it go.
Yeah, exactly.
Just walk off. It'd be all right if I said, sorry, I shouldn't have said that. That was me. That was completely the wrong expression, wasn't it? We could have a laugh about it. But no, I just, it's out there, and then just head down, walk in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Self-loathing.
I think, yeah. Thank you for just glossing over the facts of what I did at the start of that.
Well, we've all done it. Don't feel bad about it. It's okay. Let it go now. We're here. We're in the interview. We're in the moment.
We're all safe.
Let's
keep
it together.
Safe environment. So I mean, I guess in terms of the way that we've started, it's kind of like a similar style in to what you've been noted for. It's that kind of slightly self-deprecating, over-analyzing of your life and your existence and the things that go on around you. Was that ever a conscious decision, or is it just what came up when you started to do stand-up?
Oh, literally just anything I can think of that I think is going to get a laugh. That's what I talk about on stage, and it ends up being construed by people as a kind of fairly miserable tirade.
Yeah.
All the things I hate and all the things I'm angry about. And maybe it's a good outlet for that. It's
kind
of therapy in a way.
Therapy is very expensive. For. Much is better it? To have people pay you to listen.
I think I'd probably need it if I wasn't doing stand-up comedy. I feel like I'm abusing people's trust. They paid for a ticket to come and see my show, and I'm just letting out all my problems and anguish on them. This is what I do. I let out all the anguish and pain I'm feeling on stage. Then everyone leaves the end feeling thoroughly miserable about their lives, and I leave feeling pretty good about myself. And also with their money in my pocket. Sorry about that, but come and see me on tour. It'll be fun.
Sounds like you've struck upon comedy gold, the kind of thing that people have spent their whole lives trying to alchemize, and yet you've got it. The let's get them in, bums on seats, kind of leave them feeling a bit agitated and ill at ease, but you're good. You're good at the end of it.
Yeah, I've kind of... It's been an odd thing, stand-up comedy, for me. It's sort of... Without wanting to sound smug, it sort of happened to me rather than me making it happen. When I started kind of 2003, it's probably a lot easier than it should have been, but there again, at the time, there wasn't so much of it on TV, and there wasn't so much money, and it was kind of just everyone trying to do it. 10 years ago, we were all people with problems, really, and people with probably mental health issues. And it was kind of easy to it was easy to progress. I think these days there's so much money and there's so much TV work for comedians. It attracts much more functional, normal, ambitious, educated, successful people who are far more articulate and together. So it's become harder in many ways to... You have to get better. You have to up your game.
Well, you said that very articulately, which I think kind of undermines slightly the point that you made. You are, I think this is part of, like, you know, I guess the way that it helps you to rationalise a weird career, though, isn't it? I mean, that's it seems to me that if you're kind of self-deprecating, I can see you sort of scrunching up your brow a bit. But, I mean, if you're self-deprecating, otherwise, you know, you have people come along on a night out and laugh at you, and that's a really great feeling. So you've got to find some way to keep a bit grounded, I suppose.
No? Yeah, well, it's inevitably you're arrogant if you do stand-up comedy. You can't help but be arrogant. And you know, everyone's got those two aspects of their personality, haven't they? There's a self-loathing there as well, but I'm definitely... I mean, I don't think people... I hope people wouldn't think I was arrogant in real life, but there's definitely a part of me, like, I'm no good at apologising for anything. Like, if I left my bag in a bus aisle or something, an old person tripped over it, I'd be like, I probably shouldn't have left that there, but to be fair, you should be dead by now. It's still there, come on. And, I think you have to be pretty arrogant, but it's... Because, you know, who would expect to get paid for standing on stage talking nonsense and trying to make people laugh? Who would think to themselves, yeah, I'm so charismatic and entertaining, people should pay for the privilege of my company. It's not, it's sort of...
Have you started charging for dinner parties yet, or is that a...
For dinner, I wouldn't, oh, I couldn't. I'm not a dinner party man. I'm not, just somewhat lacking in social skills and any sort of... I feel like I'm retreating a little bit from humanity. I think I'd avoid them at all costs. I don't... You sort of... That's the thing with old friends, is when you haven't seen them for a while, you meet... I find a lot of people I grew up with, kind of, you meet up and they've changed a little bit. They've become a sort of strange middle-class parody of themselves. Oh, do you want to come to my dinner party? No, not even if I was starving in the gutter, but thanks for the invite. And and then you find yourself at places where... Dinner parties, you think, I don't know, I have anything in common with these people. These quail's eggs are scrumptious. I don't belong here in any sense.
More of a chicken's egg man.
I'm more of a sort of, microwave meal for one. Have a cry in front of the television. That's it, that's me. Oh, I'm turning this bleak now, this evening, aren't I?
Sounds like a Lonely Hearts ad, this.
In many ways it is. Come and find me. If love's out there, I'm here for you. I'm looking, but you should be looking as well. And I'm right here. I'm a moderately successful man. I'm working, you know, I'm earning a reasonable, if precarious, living. I can, you know, I'm here, we can have good times together, come and find me, but only if you've got a face and, you know, just... And if you shower, that's it, that's my requirements, that's it.
And a propensity for weeping, I think those things together...
Yeah, we can weep together, come and weep with me, we'll have a weeping evening, and oh, it'd be so much fun. Come to the tour, it's everywhere, I'm going... come to Bath, because there's loads of seats there. It's 450 seats, and I will never get close to selling all of them. So I need you there. Come to Bath, wherever you are. Travel to Bath for that one. Where else am I going?
I mean, you are going all over. It's almost 50 dates, isn't it?
Yeah, it's 50. I think we're going to add a few more. Where else? Hull and Leeds.
Big up for Hull. And, that's my nearest hometown.
Yeah, it's good for comedy. They're good, great comedy crowds, actually. I've always had nice gigs in... Fun gigs in Hull, and... for some reason, it's weird. Some cities work better than others for gigs. And Leeds or Brighton, I think I'm doing pretty soon. And just getting all over the place.
This is the No Escape. There is No Escape tour.
Yeah, there is No Escape. And sort of, I think...
I mean, you've got pretty much blanket coverage of the UK. In that sense, quite a literal No Escape message for the audience.
It's everywhere, and I would advise people to have a look on my website if they're interested in coming. AndrewLawrenceComedy.co.uk. There we go. We've done the plug. That's just painful for me. It's probably as painful as you feel as it was for me. But I have to. I don't want to be homeless. So buy a ticket, come and tour, and there'll be weeping, as we've suggested earlier in the interview. It might just be.
The promise of microwave meals as well? Does that still stand?
If I can make enough money to keep myself in boxes of tissues for weeping, not for anything else, I don't want to go down that road, and microwave meals, I'm very happy. Well, happy is a strong word.
It's a very relative term, isn't it?
I can keep off the medication. That's more.
And that's what the centre's advised.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, Andrew, look, thank you for coming down and chatting to us.
You too.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Andrew Lawrence.
You too.
Well, there you have it, the end of another entertaining Dave Weekly, if I do say so myself. And I Do, because those are two of my favourite guests, Bill Bailey and Andrew Lawrence, two of the most mirthful men I think that we've had on the show. Just pure joy, apart from Andrew Lawrence, because there's a slice of despair in there too, but that's what makes him excellent. We'll be back with more of the same next week. In the meantime, do check us out on iTunes and tweet us at @join_Dave and me, of course, at Ben Shires. Until then, as always, toodles doodles. The Dave Weekly is a Pixiu production for Dave, hosted by me, Ben Shires, and produced by Joel Porter.
Would you give your mum, dad, aunt, or that uncle who hugged your partner a little too long free access to your phone?
Oh, no! Oh, my God, it's a really long video. Ew!
In Dave's brand new YouTube original, Get Off My Phone, we've got six comedians to give their phones over to a relative with total freedom to read messages, DMs, photos, and browser history.
Where's your social history?
Sorry?
What to do, tips for relief.
The rules are simple. Their relative can read anything they want and even make calls from the comedian's phone.
What is this? What is...
I know what this one is.
That looks really bad.
Starring Tanya Moore, Anya Magliano, Finlay Christie, Travis J with his mum Angie Lamar, Hayley Morris, Grace Campbell and dad Alistair Campbell.
Slightly sexually compromising people.
Divulging their deepest digital secrets.
What the hell is happening?
Get Off My Phone, a Dave YouTube original. Available now on Dave's YouTube channel.